Donald Mackay is an interesting man. I've only recently met with Donald, but he's pretty famous in the trade area. Now, if you think that South Africa is an open economy, what we mean by that is that 50% of our economic activity, our GDP, is either imports or exports, then you'd think that trade would be the number one topic of conversation. Well, it isn't. It should be. We'll find out from Donald now why, and also where he sees things going. Thanks for joining us, Donald. It's, I suppose, your namesake, Donald Trump, has actually brought trade onto the front pages, if you like, or into the consciousness. But from your perspective, you know, people don't wake up or grow up saying, "I'm going to be thinking of customs tariffs and port logistics." And I mean, these are really complicated, complex areas. It's much easier to be a sportsman, maybe. So what drew you to this line of work?
Well, it was completely accidental. Largely, I just didn't want to go to the army after school. And I had to go and study something, which, again, had nothing to do with what I do now. But when I worked at Deloitte for 7 years before setting up this business. And in that time, I made friends with someone who was in the process of setting up a business unit in Deloitte, looking particularly at customs issues in those days. And I joined that unit and we grew it quite substantially. And it just, trade really started fascinating me. So I just took it a little bit further, looked at the policy space, industrial policy, logistics, and all of these other things that sit around trade. It's fascinating. And South Africa is a small trade-dependent economy, so it's extremely relevant in our lives.
Are we a bit like a cork on the ocean, or can we determine anything about what happens with our trade, given that we are so small in the global environment?
We are small, and you could really break the world into small and large economies, and they behave very differently in the world. And this has probably been seen at the moment with the difference between how China has responded to President Trump compared to pretty much everyone else. And so I think sometimes we think we're more influential than we are. We're a big player in Africa, but that's just because we have a large economy. Our trade with Africa is in fact quite modest. So I think we believe we're more influential than we are, but we have potential to be if we get a few things right, I guess.
That's funny. It's a South African malaise, perhaps, that we see the world as we want it to be rather than what it really is. So just where are we if you were to take us on a global ranking? How far behind China and the US do we fall, and who do we rank alongside?
Oh, I mean, we're so far beyond China or the US or the EU. So let me perhaps describe it this way. The EU is our single biggest trading partner. We export about 22% of everything to the EU. And that 22% of our exports accounts for less than 0.5% of Europe's imports. If you look at the US, pre-Trump, US was kind of 7-8% of our exports. Africa's total imports into the US is less than 0.5% of their imports. So we're extremely small.
Michelle's the mom who traded in her Fiat 500 for this beast right here. But why the momentous move, huh?
I needed something bigger to keep up with my growing son and his many sports bags.
When you traded in your car with WeBuyCars, was it an easy conversion?
I see what you did there. The process was just so easy. I was given a tablet, had to sign, and that was it.
Basically, WeBuyCars is no mess, no fuss. Okay, it was nice chatting. WeBuyCars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
Okay, that kind of puts us into perspective. I believe you're a bit of a foodie, or you've been described as a forensic foodie. So unpacking the ingredients to find out how they work together and that. Do you do that as well in your business, in XA Global Trade Advisors? Do you unpack all the little bits and see how they fit together?
Yeah, so I am quite obsessed with how things work. Much of our job actually involves unpicking things and trying to work out why things operate the way they do. In an economic sense, you know, question that often strikes me is, why does South Africa perform as poorly as we do? Why do our policies, some of which are good on paper, many of which I would argue are not good on paper, and thank God we're bad at implementing them, but why do they not work is an important question. So absolutely, a lot of our time is spent trying to understand the why, but the food is more fun.
So you started XA Global Trade Advisors 20 years ago. There we go. I've given you two punts now with your name. So we know what the name of your firm is. What was it not negotiable? What was when you started it off and you said, I will not compromise on this area?
Well, I need to maybe describe why I started the business. I had no intention of ever leaving Deloitte. And then Enron happened in the US and the whole Arthur Andersen debacle. And suddenly everything about how we worked fundamentally altered. And I just found myself moving from a place where I really enjoyed what I did to being quite miserable. You know, I'd left Deloitte being quite unhappy with how the industry had shifted and didn't really have a clear plan on what to do. So in fact, while sitting home, Deloitte asked me if I wouldn't come back on a contract basis. And I did that for a few months, but that made no sense whatsoever. Just kind of sitting on the other side of the fence, but basically going through the same stuff. And so I canceled the contract and went off on my own. And that was 22 years ago. To your question, I guess, what were the non-negotiables? The one thing I tell all of my staff, particularly new people when they come in, is that we're always absolutely honest with our clients, even when the clients may not like what we have to say. I think it's extremely important in a country that is so politicized, where everybody is perpetually just trying to say the right thing to not upset someone else, that often good advice is lost because there's somehow a fear that somebody would be offended. So we're certainly not going out of our way to be offensive, but when clients ask us for a view on something or advice on something, we try as well as possible to be as unfiltered as possible so that they can make the best decisions in their own business.
Now that's very honorable, but it's also very expensive. There are some clients who would fire you. As we know, government kind of likes firing people who don't agree with them, and some big businesses feel exactly the same way. Have you lost business that way by speaking truth to power? Because I guess that's what you're doing in the end result.
Yeah. So fortunately, government is typically not a client of ours, even though we work with government all the time. There absolutely are clients who have been unhappy with us, and not, I should point out, because of the quality of the work, but because they don't always like the results. But having said that, we're also incredibly selective about who we take on as a client. So we could all be quite a bit wealthier if we were a little less filtered in who we brought on. But we are quite careful with who we work.
Have you ever had a moment where you've been warned to back off and where you thought, it isn't worth it? The system's just too big to keep fighting. We'll compromise here.
Well, we've been in position. We've certainly been in positions where pressure has been applied. We've never had anyone give a threat to us. We have ever had a couple of people who've had a go at us in the media and that sort of thing. We've never yet run into a situation where we've felt ourselves truly cornered. That might be, you know, simply a fact that we're not as big as one of the really large law firms or accounting firms are. But we have fortunately not been in a position where any kind of ultimatums have ever been given to us.
But you're working in an industry or an area where there's lots of illogical things happening. It's almost like you can pull your hair out when you see what's happening in South Africa's criminal justice system. On the trade side as well, there must be intense frustration. So how do you get your team when new people join you? How do you actually make sure that they don't throw their hands up and run for cover after just a little while of taking just one too many hits?
Yeah, I mean that is a real issue. It is an incredibly high pressured industry we work in. It is not for everyone, and so that is a perpetual concern. We put a lot of effort into trying to work out how we kind of compensate for the abrasiveness of the bigger environment that we work in. But it is a difficult challenge. We occasionally do lose extremely good people who would like to just do something that's a little simpler. But having said that, it's hard to get a job with us. We've got quite an intense recruitment process. We spend a lot of time trying to get the right people who are invigorated and excited by the challenges presented in the work that we do.
I know I'm hammering away at this, but I just want to get a little bit of a better feel of yourself and the company that you've built. What was your darkest day? What was a day when you thought, no, come on, these guys have now completely lost it and they are just beyond redemption?
Well, my darkest day was probably a decade or maybe a little bit more ago. We were dealing with a very large matter involved with a very large European group. And we simply made a mistake. We were all working through the night. It was 4 a.m. in the morning. And we made a mistake. And when we realized the mistake had been made, we also realized that if this particular client sued us, it would pretty much be the end of the business. And we contacted our professional indemnity insurance, who said to us, look, under no circumstances can you admit any guilt. And my partner and I sat for a few hours debating this and then promptly picked up the phone, called the CEO, and actually explained what had happened. They were not happy, but we resolved everything and they've remained a client. But it was a moment where I truly thought, this is how it ends. Doesn't matter that it's an honest mistake. It would have cost them hundreds of millions. And that was terrifying. But we felt the only way to go through this was to be open. And I guess in the whole business, we've never had another instance like that. But it was frightening. And that's a story, by the way, we tell all of our staff so that they're always comfortable coming to us if they make mistakes.
That's interesting. Many people talk about, go and make mistakes because that's part of the learning process. But when it actually happens, it can be a very different result or reaction from your employer.
Yeah. So we've had a few people that have made mistakes afterwards, but no one ever gets into trouble for making a mistake. They will, however, get fired if they hide it.
Ah, yeah. Okay, so let's move on to where we are right now. Are you fundamentally an optimist or a pessimist about South Africa's future as a global trade partner?
I'm desperately wanting to be more optimistic than I am. Might be a good description. You've got to remember, though, South Africa's a tiny economy globally. There's only so much control we have over our own fate. So a good way to think of this would be, we want to be a good trading partner to other countries. I think our trading system in South Africa is heavily politicized. And it, of course, we've seen in the US what happens with a highly politicized system. That does worry me because on balance, that tends to yield poorer outcomes than a less politicized system. There's continuous flow over. So you would recall at the end of last year, I forget who the ANC politician was, who went on and on about renaming Sandton Drive, it's not the embassy, my apologies, the consulate is situated. So, you know, these sorts of things place a kind of burden on the average South African that doesn't need to be there. And South Africa politically has always kind of punched above its weight. But, you know, a few months ago, I wrote an article saying, at some point, the bigger guy is going to punch back and we have to be careful. And now we have Donald Trump and we've seen what that feels like. This is not to justify what Trump has done. I think that's terrible. But at the same time, we've set ourselves up to be in a weak position where we didn't need to be.
A little bit like a small dog yapping and yapping at a calm relaxed, bigger dog who couldn't be bothered and then one day is bothered.
Yes, yes. So we've made a lot of enemies and I don't always know why. And some of the friends we're making make it difficult to have friends that can benefit us. So, you know, the most obvious is Iran most recently. You know, we do essentially no trade with Iran. Why are we spending political capital with Iran? But we do. And we do the same thing with Cuba and so on.
Now, what you're saying now is often discussed amongst South Africans, but never quantified. So, and you're in a unique position, given the focus that you have in your life and your business, to be able to quantify that. These bad relationships that we have with the polecats of global society, are they hurting South African exports and by the same token hurting the South African growth story?
So let me give you a few numbers which I know offhand. So if you take Russia as an example, we've called ourselves non-aligned. I don't think anyone honestly believes we're non-aligned in the Russia situation. But if you take the value of our exports to Russia, we export more to Eswatini than we do to Russia. If you take all of the BRICS countries, the expanded BRICS, and you just take out China and India, you look at all the rest, our exports to Zimbabwe are bigger than our exports to all of the others combined, but Brazil and everyone. So I find it weird. It's not clear to me what the strategy is in the groupings we're in. So I'm not saying we shouldn't be part of these groupings, but we've got to think very carefully what the upside to being in there is. That's kind of the one leg. But the other side is, what is the cost you pay? So what is the cost that we end up paying when we align ourselves with less attractive partners in the world? And that becomes very hard to quantify because it's very often the trade or investment that didn't happen. But we've got to kind of think, are we going to be principled, which I think doesn't tend to work out into the long term? Are we going to focus on our own interests, which I could understand that was kind of the Henry Kissinger perspective that said, just focus on your interests. But it's not obvious to me that we're really doing either of those. And so the result is we seem to be kind of blown by the wind, and that makes us a unpredictable partner to be in business with.
Is there a desire to address this? Is there a desire by those who govern us? And given that we have now a government of national unity rather than the ANC hegemony that we had for so long, to actually fix this?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, to be honest, Alec. I mean, the evidence would indicate no, but I think there is an awareness that what Trump has done is he's forced a realignment across the whole globe. And so the realignment is having to happen. We have some control over who we align with. I'm not privy. I'm not in the political side of the government. So I don't really know politically how these things are viewed. But I think the GNU is really just a group of people who don't like each other that have been locked in a room together. We at some point have got to figure out what our economic strategy is. And it can't simply be just, endlessly putting lipstick on the pig of very bad economic policy. So the GNU itself doesn't appear to cohere. So perhaps the Bosparat that happened just the other day, maybe that will help. I don't know. But I also have no idea what happened there. But the GNU appears to still largely be the ANC. And that's fine. But it doesn't, that's not what the voters are being told. So I think the GNU's got to figure out its economic policy. And it's not obvious to me that that is happening.
It does appear to those of us who are outside of that tent, that particular tent, that the ANC just keeps doubling down. And certainly I've now had from two people who I respect their opinions saying, but it's a deliberate policy of the ANC to actually not fix the economy and not to make people more educated. Whether or not that is the case, and please God, it isn't. It's terrifying to think that there are people, respected people in our society, who actually believe that we have governors who want to keep us poor and dumb.
Yeah, I that's too cynical even for me. I mean, I know many, many of the ANC politicians. I'm not saying all of them are angels, but I've never met anyone. And that's just perhaps because I'm meeting the wrong people. But I've never met anyone who kind of truly doesn't want South Africa to be better. And I mean, whether the mechanisms being used are the right ones, I think is slightly different. But also, you know, the GNU has other parties in. It's not clear to me why the other parties appear to have no ability to do anything. You know, so they're as passive as the ANC is controlling. And so if you're gonna give blame, surely it would have to be spread across all of them who, you know, themselves don't appear to be doing anything different.
All right. So let's assume then that those who govern us in Pretoria do want to fix the economy. But why then are they, apparently from what I can see, centralizing everything, trying to get more control together? Do they not get that model is gone and it doesn't work in a highly complex world that we now inhabit?
Yeah, but we shouldn't forget that the ANC at the end of the day is still a socialist party. So if you leave aside the fact that I don't think socialism works and I think capitalism would deliver better outcomes, the ANC is a socialist party, and a socialist solution to a problem is ultimately going to come down to more control, not less control. The point of a GNU is that you'd have some other voices in there who might have a different view and have some ability to influence. Now, again, I don't know why that is not happening at any kind of scale. I don't think the sort of budget version 3 that we went through this year is an indication of a functioning GNU. It feels to me more like it's an indication of a GNU that has no ability to talk to each other and sort of ends up with this as the fight. So it still feels as if the fundamental economics are still socialist in leaning, perhaps not in every way. But I think that will consistently give bad outcomes no matter what your intentions are.
So we've got a bunch of guys who say, yes, our GDP per capita has not grown for a long time. But that's only because we haven't applied the socialist rules correctly. That, for better or worse, that's the way these guys are thinking. Tell me about the International Trade Administration Commission of South Africa, because that to me seems to be an organization which just aligns with this whole idea of centralizing, or the ANC centralizing the economy or its control more.
Yeah, so the commission used to be more independent than it has become. And we could say, by the way, the same thing about the Competition Commission. So the two have at heart very similar legislation, and you know, both of them have become more politicized. I think the challenge you've got is if the perspective you have is, you know, my job as a commissioner, I mean, I'm not a commissioner, but if I was, my job is to implement government's policy. If that is the view, in other words, we've got an economic policy that is largely a socialist policy. My job is I've got to implement that. That would manifest one way. If the other way is I've got to consider the facts of a particular case from both sides and then look at the economics of it and decide accordingly, you would have different outcomes. And we can see that over the years. So if you look at the early days of the International Trade Administration Commission, it looked considerably different to how it looks now. And much of that is a reflection of how the economic politics of South Africa has shifted left from the period. You know, we think back to Minister Rob Davies, who came straight out of the SACP. There was a dramatic leaning to the left. That is pretty much not changed.
Ibrahim Patel as well was pretty forceful in his ideas. And yet, even if they don't work, it doesn't seem to ring any bells that maybe we can try something different. So I guess the real result of this is that the public have got to say, we want to try something different, so we'll have to vote differently. I guess that's really the whole story.
Well, I think it's part of it. But what we instead seen is there's a recognition it hasn't worked. And so what they've attempted to do is, for example, getting you to contract your commitments. So if you're going to get something from us, we need you to sign something that's called an irrevocable undertaking, which is this quite onerous agreement that says, you know, if we're going to give you X, you've got to give us Y, you've got to report back every quarter and so on. The Competition Commission has a version of this, which they call public interest, which is the same thing. You want to get your merger approved, you are going to have to make a contribution into the localization support fund, whatever the case might be. So what is happening is there's an attempt to grow employment, for example, by saying, if I'm going to give you this concession, you have to promise to employ more people. And so rather than addressing the macro environment, which is why we have an unemployment problem, we're attempting to fix the unemployment problem sort of one investigation at a time, rather than, so if you think for a minute of the number of companies at the Competition Commission that deal with a merger in a year, you know, in any given year, it's a rounding error. It's a tiny number of businesses. There may be big businesses, but they're a very small part of the economy. So even if you got the biggest company in South Africa to make a commitment to increase its employment by 10% or 20%, this is not going to change the unemployment problem. But this is how we're dealing with this. So we're not fixing the macro reasons for us not being productive. And so we're attempting to fix it at the micro level. And that just will never work.
Yeah, and you go home at night and say, well, I've created another 1,000 jobs because I've forced Massmart in their deal with Walmart to take on certain issues. But doesn't it also have a very scary unintended consequence of us becoming more like the Americans, more like a lobby economy? You get the people to go and talk to the politicians. In our country, it's not just talk. There's a lot more that seems to happen there because we don't have the lifestyle audits we should have. And the politicians will then give you what you want.
Yes. So we absolutely have become a lobby economy. And lobby economies at their heart don't function well because it's a perpetual overriding of market signals to accomplish something. So everyone got very upset when we found out about the Guptas and, you know, them wanting SAA to cancel certain routes, etc. And of course, that was connected to a bribe. But if you took the bribe out of it and you put another company's name in there, we see fundamentally the same thing. So, you know, we spend a lot of time studying court cases, and it is astonishing how many times in a dispute you will find out that company A had been investing lots of time with a particular minister to get an outcome. I'm not suggesting they were bribing them, but what has happened is the transparency is so poor that we have no idea what goes on. And so our policies become dictated by the very large companies in the country. And, you know, that's not really a secret to anyone, but it's also why the economy remains as concentrated as it is, with very large companies remaining dominant. Maybe some of the names have changed, but ultimately the economy hasn't in any way, just become deconcentrated in the last 30 years.
Mm. So the way to get rich nowadays is not to graft hard and find a new idea and serve the community better. It's to join a big corporate and work your way up and get your share options. And because you're always going to be well positioned given the massive lobbying. You know, it's interesting, Donald, on this as an aside. I read recently that, a couple of years ago, that for each journalist that exists, there are something like 8 people in what they call corporate journalism, i.e. in lobbying. And I guess when you have a look at the courts that we deal with, it must be a similar situation with the private sector in the court of law, where private lawyers outnumber the public prosecutors, certainly in brain power, by an exponential amount. That can't be healthy going into the future.
Yeah, I never thought about it that way, but I can't imagine that delivers good outcomes at all. The minute you're striking a secret deal with someone, there's almost certainly many people on the other side of that are going to pay for it. And, you know, so I mean, one of the arguments we've made repeatedly is an easy and cost effective way to deal with this is to legally force up levels of transparency. So just the idea that you know, the default position when asking for something from government is that it's always confidential. You know, the default has to be the opposite. But that is not what happened. So we've got wonderful organizations like Open Secrets who do a very good job of putting information into the public sphere. But, you know, they can't do this at scale. You know, many of those nonprofits can do tiny bits of it. It has to be at a larger scale.
Yeah, it's a drop in the ocean when you have a look at what's really happening behind the scene. Help us understand, or help me understand something, if you would. I've had numerous conversations with Cobus Verster of ArcelorMittal, and he often talks about the scrap metal industry being advantaged and ArcelorMittal being disadvantaged, and as a consequence, that's why they have to close down the steel plant in my hometown, where I grew up, in Newcastle. What's going on in scrap metal? What is the real story there, and is there lobbying that is occurring here too?
Yeah. So the lobbying here has truly gotten out of control. So what happened is around 2012 or 2013, the lobbying started with Minister Patel at the time to impose some controls on exporting, and so was born a system called the price preference system, which is essentially a program that says, if I have scrap steel and I want to export it, I first have to offer it to the domestic industry at a 30% discount. And then if nobody wishes to buy it at that discount, I can then export it. But then what happened is, over time, the lobbying increased. And we ended up in, I think it was 2022, we ended up with Treasury also imposing an export duty on scrap. So now, if you couldn't sell it locally at the 30% discount, if you exported it, you would now pay a 20% export duty. It was never meant to be that way. The one was meant to replace the other. But here is where the secret lobbying happened. And all of this came out in a set of court papers. We've published a report on it. We've identified who the people were that were doing the lobbying, because the effect of that has been quite profound. So there's a value transfer that we calculated at about 8.5 billion rand a year from generators of scrap metal, the factory, Transnet, whoever, to the consumers of scrap metal, these mini mills. And by the way, a new one is about to open in Nigel, so there'll be 11 of them. And coupled to this, you have the IDC providing friendly finance. We don't know at what price, but finance. So the IDC's exposure to the mini mill sector, according to Minister Patel, about 2 years ago, was 14 billion rand. And so just to kind of put this into perspective, the mini mills supply somewhere around 20% of the steel consumed in South Africa. This is pre the Newcastle closures. It might have shifted a bit. But the 20% of South Africa's steel, Mittal provides 50%, and importers account for about 30%. Mittal's market cap is 1.5 billion. So it's very hard to not see that a bubble has kind of been inflated, an investment bubble. And the outcome of that has been we're in a market where the whole world is oversupplied with steel, but we continue to funding the investment in making more steel. And so predictably what started happening is the Newcastle operation of Mittal competes most closely with the mini mills. And unlike China, where you could still impose a tariff against China, you can't impose a tariff against the mini mills because they're all domestic. And so those subsidies caused a price collapse in the price of steel produced out of scrap metal. Mittal was unable to compete. That wasn't the only reason, to be clear, Alec, but they were unable to compete. And so, you know, they said one of the things government has to do is to cut back its support of the mini mills. But that, of course, is politically unpalatable. And so instead, what government did was they said to Mittal, well, we're going to think about all of this. We'll give you can't remember the exact amount. I think it was 2 billion rand, thereabouts, to keep your operations running for another 6 months. But of course, fundamentally, the big issues didn't change. And now it looks as if the IDC might become the proud owner of Mattel. The last news report I saw, I have no inside information on this. The last news report I saw, I think the offer was 8 or 8.5 billion rand for Mattel. So this is the effect of policies that are not properly modeled. And you can't save everything. If you're going to do something to one area, it almost inevitably is going to have an effect elsewhere. It seldom has an effect that is so stark as we can see here. But you know, one of the casualties of this program has been Mattel Newcastle.
Who owns those mini mills?
So there are many, many different people. There's a new one in Nigel. Apparently, it has Chinese shareholders. I don't know who the people are. We have Score Metals, which is owned by the Barnes Group, which have quite a number of steel operations. There's Cape Gate, which is another one. Don't know who their shareholders are offhand. There is Cisco, not the IT company, Cisco in the Western Cape, which has changed hands a few times. I think at present their shareholders is another Gupta family from Tanzania, but not our Guptas. Not those. A completely different family has apparently bought them. So I don't know who all of the shareholders are, but there are many of them. Many, many of them.
So clearly I must just make a note of that. Sorry. So clearly their lobbying power is a lot stronger than ArcelorMittal's.
Yes. So it would appear so. Again, I'll, if you like, Alec, I'll send you the report we did on this. You can have a look for yourself. But the nub of all of this was that there were people from the mini mill sector combined with people from within government that were then lobbying government. In fact, some of the people literally worked for the same department that had to make the decision on this, got together, did some secret lobbying, and it absolutely was secret. There was a refusal to disclose any information until it was compelled in the court case. So that is a perfect example of how not to formulate policy.
And the dangers of the lobbying economy.
Absolutely. So, you know, this is not to say that, well, support should be given to Mattel or the others. The question is, why was it done in secret and why was that acceptable? Perhaps the same conclusion would have been arrived at, but I don't think so.
Is there any glimmer of hope? Is there any little bit of breaking through of bright light? And I think here, specifically an area that you know very well on the ports, the Philippine owners of a big part of the Durban harbor, would that not be some indication that we are moving in the right direction somewhere?
Yes, absolutely. So our ports and the connected railway system are absolutely crucial to South Africa's global competitiveness. At present, Durban Port is literally the worst performing port in the world. 2 years ago, that worst performing port was Cape Town. So we're not doing well in this space. Fixing that up is crucial because you can think of the dysfunctional port like a tax on every single export you do. So it simply adds a cost to trading that should not be there. That kind of friction is very, very damaging. So I'm incredibly optimistic about the Filipino company that will take over the management of Durban, that they're credible. They do this elsewhere in the world. I don't know practically how that unfolds, but there's nothing wrong with the company that was appointed. So I'm feeling positive. I'm also feeling positive just in general around how Transnet is starting to kind of get its stuff together. You know, Transnet is just not the same as it used to be. And I think that's all good news. So it's going to take time. You can't kind of do this overnight, but it's always going to take time. That is a very encouraging sign for me, and I'm happy to see it happening.
It's almost getting back to what you said earlier, that you are not a cynic. You don't believe that we have people in Pretoria where the overwhelming majority or the majority of them are wanting to actually rip off the country and make the country poorer and make us uneducated. But it's just that they might have been doing the wrong things. And here and there, we're starting to see that some of the right things are being done, which is positive for us into the future.
Absolutely. I've chosen to live the rest of my life in South Africa because I don't want to leave. I want South Africa to work, I think, as most of us do. And, you know, so I remain hopeful. I'd like to see things move a bit quicker, but Transnet has the potential to make an enormous difference to our economy if they can follow through and actually do these things as they should.
Donald McKay will continue speaking truth to power. He is the founder and chief executive of XA Global Trade Advisors. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.